We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dead on the air. And welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 4th of August 2009. It's a Canadian special today. We'll be looking at the situation in Canada. Don't forget, you can listen to this program on our website later on. If you can't listen to it all now, at www.dadsontheair.net. The website has been relaunched in recent times and redesigned. It's a much more functional and much better looking site, thanks to the wonderful work of Greg Andreessen, our researcher. So do look at that. And I'd just like to welcome everybody in the studio. We have Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, everybody.
And myself, John Stapleton. First up, who have we got on?
Well, this week we look at the struggle for family law reform in Canada, the home of some of the world's most extreme anti-male, anti-father legislation. Recently on Dads on the Air, we interviewed Canadian MP Maurice Vellacott, who has introduced shared parenting legislation into the Canadian Parliament. This week we follow on from that interview by talking with the highly experienced former family lawyer Karen Selleck, who has been an outspoken proponent for reform of the system. We also speak with Roger Galloway, MP, who co-chaired an inquiry into shared parenting in Canada, and Jeffrey Asher, a lecturer on men's studies who taught the last men's studied course in the country. With Australia's left-wing government heading in exactly the opposite direction to the rest of the Western world and winding back the modest reforms of the previous government promoting cooperative care of children after divorce, now is the perfect time to look at the situation around the world. Canadian society and many tens of thousands of fathers and their children have paid a very high price for the country's previous embrace of extreme anti-male ideology, and numerous voices are now united in a call for sanity to prevail.
And with the latest developments on shared parenting, on the line we have Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning, Phil. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Keeping very, very busy, and I have to announce to all the fathers' groups, all the men's groups, if you thought you could settle back and take some pleasure in the gains that we made in 2006, please think again. You need to, you know, gather your strength again and start to protest and lobby as much as we ever did before. In fact, it's even more important now. I had a conversation just recently with Kay Hull, who is the federal MP who chaired the joint custody inquiry. She is deeply concerned about the changes that have been mooted by the Attorney General and the thought of what we think is going to happen. She is trying to gather as much support as she can within her party room with her colleagues. There is some opposition. Some of the coalition are even believing the Barbara Biggs type stories that are coming out, you know, where fathers are mutilating their children on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So she's got her work cut out for her. But what she has asked of us is to make sure that we get all our people to make appointments, particularly with the Labor Party politicians, and sit across the desk and explain to these politicians exactly what we expect of them as far as family law is concerned, how well shared parenting is working out for some parents, and how we need to have much more shared parenting in operation. And she said that there was nothing quite as confronting for a politician to be greeted by electorate members sitting across the desk from you and requesting these things to happen. You virtually can't avoid it. You're a captive audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the federal MPs or
federal members of parliament. Yes, it's all federal, Phil,
yep.
At this level. And we need to do, if you are in a seat where you have a coalition member, by all means make an appointment with them. We may have one of the ones that are wavering in their support for shared parenting laws. We need to convince them that it is working and it's the best interest of the children.
And indeed it is. And I guess, you know, it's up to us to show the other side, because there's certainly a camp of groups and people out there that are going to these politicians positions and saying that it's not working?
Oh, they've done an enormous amount of work. Whilst it's all been quiet, and in the last days of the Howard government, they've been very, very busy in the back rooms and in the universities, etc., working out their plan of campaign.
Yep.
And we see if on up on YouTube there are a number of videos that have been made using the services of various so-called support people, counsellors, psychologists who are totally against shared parenting and are supporting the message that the extreme women's groups are putting out, and that is that shared parenting is, they're suggesting, is not good for children and it puts women at risk and children at risk of all these dangerous men that are out there.
Yep, so as you said, it really is a critical time for everyone to ring up and make that appointment and talk to their local federal MPs in regards to shared parenting.
That's right. We need to get them to move. It's not a question of, oh, I'll do it tomorrow, I'll do it later. Pick up your phone book now, get their number, ring them up, make an appointment, go down and sit there with them for 10, 15 minutes, put your side of the story, particularly if you happen to be a parent who has shared parenting, that you can point to the success of it and how it's working out best for the children and both the parents.
Yep.
And that's what we need to do.
Indeed we do. And just on that, you know, there was the episode on 60 Minutes on Sunday night. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. Just remind me. I probably heard about it though. I think I read the transcript.
Okay. So yeah, it is in the mainstream media, and it is something that the politicians certainly got at the highest level within federal politics, and it's now is the time for us to all get in there and talk to our federal politicians, because if we don't do it now, there may be a chance that we won't get to do it again.
Well, you won't get the opportunity until the coalition comes back into power, which will happen eventually, but who knows when at the current rate.
Yep.
It's interesting to note also that the Family Law Court released a new case out of Tasmania, and everyone jumped on saying, oh, it was a terrible decision for the mother and the children, and they had actually banned the father from knowing where the mother and children are and where they're living. They've been given permission to relocate to wherever they want to go to. But I had a read of the case, and it was a decision by Justice Benjamin, and it seemed to me that he had good reason for making the orders that he did. There were numerous claims of domestic violence and breaches of orders and threats of serious threats of harm against the mother and the children, and the judge effectively gave her permission to move, relocate, rename for their own safety. Of course, this is the same judge who last year made a decision for a child to be relocated with the father in Melbourne away from the mother and her parents because it was considered that they would not be encouraging contact with the father. So here we have an example of a judge making one decision in favour of a child living with dad, another decision of children living with the mother, and protecting the safety of all these parties. So it's got nothing to do with shared parenting. They're not putting children at risk through shared parenting. And, that, I think, is why the family court probably released those two judgments.
Yeah, it shows quite clearly that their interests are in the children.
That's right, as they should be.
As they should be, absolutely. And I guess in saying that, our interests right now need to be with the children as well, because if we don't talk to our federal politicians now, it's not only our generation that will be affected by it, it could be our children's generation as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
we need to move on this now.
Yeah, we do need to move on it. Phil, I tried to express that with all the people who come through to us, that maybe we can't do anything for you, maybe it's too late for your particular circumstances, but think about what sort of future you're leaving for your children if we leave family law in such a chaotic situation as it would be if we go back to the 80-20 regime.
That's right. And for everyone that contacts their federal MP, basically it equates to, like, what is it, like 100 or 200 votes?
I'm not sure, but that, yes, like it, that. It is a tremendous, a much greater percentage that they attribute to that contact because people have actually made the effort.
Yeah, exactly.
But what we'd like to know is if you do make a contact with an MP and you have a meeting, can you send a report in? You know, can you send a report in to Dads on the Air or even to us?
Yep.
We'd like to know about it. We want to know how successful the campaign's been.
Mm-hmm.
We need to push it through and really get people motivated and active in this.
Okay, so for you, Sue, what would be the best email? Would it be support@mensrights.com.au?
Yeah, that would be fine, Phil.
Okay, so everyone, if you could send out an email to Sue or to us here. Sue's email is support@mensrights.com.au. Thanks for your time this morning, Sue.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Keep up the good work.
Good morning to you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
It's the perfect time of year, somewhere far away from here. I feel fine enough, I guess, considering everything's a mess. There's a restaurant down the street where hungry people like to eat. I could walk, but I'll just drive. It's colder than it looks outside. It's like a dream you try to remember, but it's gone. Then you're trying to scream, but it only comes out as a yawn. When you're trying to see the woman on your front door, take your time, cause the way I'm gonna make you smile. When you realize that it can't last, it might take a while. Just to try to figure out what all this is for. It's the perfect time of day to throw all your cares away. Put the sprinkler on the lawn and run through with my gym shorts on. Take a drink right from the hose and change into some drier clothes. Climb the stairs up to my room, sleep away the afternoon. It's like a dream you try to remember, but it's gone. Then you're trying to scream, but it only comes out as a yawn. When you're trying to sleep, it won't be on your front door. Take your time, the way I'm gonna make you smile. When you realize that I got my son, might take a while. Just to try to figure out what all this is for. Finish me. Finish me, cause I'm still asleep. Please God, tell me that I'm still asleep. On an evening such as this,
yo,
it's hard to tell if I exist.
Yeah,
I pack the car and leave this town. Notice that I'm not around. I could hide out under there. I just made you say underwear. I could leave, but I'll just stay. All my stuff's here anyway. Like a dream, you're trying to remember, but it's gone. Then you're trying to scream, but it'll become done as a yawn. When you try to see the woman on your front door, take your time, so wait, how long you make you smile. When you realize it, again, my side might take a while. Just to try to figure out what all this is for.
Finish me.
Try to figure out what all this is for.
Finish me.
Try to see the woman on your front door.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And now we have the honour of having Karen Selleck. She's a family lawyer from Canada on the line. You there, Karen?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. Now, Ian is just going here is just going to give a bit of background on you. Here we go.
Okay, our first guest, Karen Selleck, is a lawyer who spent approximately 22 years practicing family law in Belleville, Ontario. During that time, she became an outspoken critic of Canada's divorce laws, including the law on marital property division, spousal support, and child custody. She has also publicly criticised the biases she observed in the courtroom. Selleck was a columnist for Canadian Lawyer magazine for approximately 17 years and currently contributes irregularly to the op-ed pages of the National Post, one of the few newspapers in the world which has over the past decade consistently run articles exposing the destructive practices of the family law industry and its bias against men. Her collected columns appear on her website at www.karenselleck.com.
So there you go. Now, Karen, can you just sort of begin at the beginning, I guess, and tell us how you all got interested in all of this?
It was not really my choice to practice family law, interestingly enough. That was something that I never intended to do. It was not an area of the law that interested me, but because of my own personal circumstances, that is when I met the man that I cohabit with, he was living in an area that the Belleville area. I was living in Toronto, and for 5 years we commuted back and forth to see each other. I was practicing tax law at the time, and finally, after 5 years, I said, "This relationship is very difficult to conduct at such a distance." So I moved to the Belleville area and just, you know, sort of, I started up with a law firm, but had to do whatever came in the door. And what comes in the door a lot in Belleville is family law. So that's what I started doing, and I guess I was pretty good at it because it kept coming. But I have to tell you the truth, I never liked doing it.
I thought you were going to say because you ended up living with a separated bloke, but he wasn't. That wasn't it. He wasn't a.
Well, in fact, he was. He was separated, and he did have custody of his two children, but that had nothing to do with it.
Right.
His two kids were almost grown up by the time we met. So, my views were not formed in any way by that.
So, why was it that area in particular? Why did it have so much family law?
Sorry, why?
The area where you came to live, what's it called again? Belleville? Why did
Belleville.
It? Belleville. Why was family law so common there? Is it a particularly poor area or?
It probably is for the province of Ontario. I suppose Hastings County is probably one of the lower income areas, but I imagine it's probably the same everywhere in Ontario these days. That is, if you're starting out as a practitioner in a small town with no particular expertise in any area. I mean, certainly I had expertise in tax law, but because Belleville is not a particularly industrial area or an area where you would expect people to need a tax lawyer, I just had to take whatever came in the door, and I think that would probably be the same in most of the certainly small towns in Ontario.
Right. Look, a lot of people who have, for Australians, and I assume it's the same for Canada, the most common experience of any normal person with the law is family law. You know, they don't usually go into courts for any other reason, you know, and they're not criminals and so on and so forth. But with family law, it affects a really large number of people. Were you shocked by what you saw?
I was, interestingly enough, when I started practicing family law, it was 1985, and the law was not actually that bad at that time. The Divorce Act and the Family Law Act, which is, the Family Law Act is provincial, that's an Ontario law, the Divorce Act is federal, so it's all of Canada. Both of them were changed within 2 years of my starting to practice family law, and both of the changes were, in my view, extremely detrimental to the law. So I started seeing things that were more and more disturbing, within the first 2 years of my practice.
Right, can you just take us through what those changes were, what the detail of it?
Okay, in the Divorce Act, the main change was we got what people refer to as no-fault divorce, which I don't have a problem with the concept of divorcing without any fault. If people are no longer happy together and they want to split up, that's fine. But what it really boiled down to was no-fault spousal support. So there used to be in the law prior to 1985, a fairly sensible provision that if you had committed marital misconduct of some sort or other, for instance, if you were guilty of adultery, you could not claim spousal support from the innocent person.
Right.
But that was thrown out the window in 1985, I guess, the change in the Divorce Act came in, so that spousal support is now independent of marital misconduct. So now we see cases where and to be frank, it's usually the man who is paying the wife. So we see cases of women who have committed adultery getting spousal support. That's a very frequent one. We see women who have actually gone and either remarried or are living in common law relationships with the people that they had affairs with or even with other people, and they still continue to get spousal support. There are women who have actually been violent towards their husband, and that was the reason for the marital breakdown. There were, women who have assaulted their husbands, burned them, stabbed them, and those women are not ineligible for spousal support because of their violence. To me, that's just bizarre.
That would create a huge amount of resentment, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, those violence cases are not that common, but nevertheless, there are examples out there, and I've certainly had clients whose wives have, scratched them with their fingernails and things like that, and that's, it doesn't matter. The spousal misconduct is irrelevant, and they still have to pay support.
And so it's support, to the wife or the former partner, not to the children.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about right now. I mean, we do have laws that also compel the non-custodial parent to pay child support to the custodial parent. Mm. But I'm talking about spousal support now.
We do have it.
That I'm particularly insensitive.
We do have spousal support in Australia, but it's not that common. It's not fairly rarely ordered, as I understand it. But it's really quite common in Canada, isn't it?
Well, in Canada, it's now virtually a matter of a means test, so that if you've been married for a fairly long time, certainly if you've been married more than 20 years, it almost goes without saying that the courts will try to virtually equalize the party's incomes, so that if a man were making, say, $70,000 a year and his wife was only making $30,000 a year and there has been a long marriage, they would certainly order the higher income spouse to pay a significant amount of spousal support. If it was only a marriage of 1 or 2 years, there might not be any spousal support ordered, but it's really a means test that's imposed and a sort of judgment call about how long the parties were together and, what roles they assumed and so on. So it's fairly common.
So doesn't that destroy incentive and, the desire to progress yourself?
Sorry,
doesn't that law, if you're suddenly, half your income's disappearing to the former wife, doesn't it destroy any incentive you might have to improve your own situation, to get more qualifications, to climb the career ladder?
Oh, certainly. Yes, absolutely, it does. And, there are some people who become quite despondent over their situation, especially if they're also paying child support, because, if their wife has custody of the children, they're paying child support, spousal support, income tax. There's not much left for the person who's paying all that. And I've known people who have... I've known people who've made all kinds of, I wouldn't say threats, but have certainly made statements to me like, gee, I'd be better off if she died, or I'd be better off, leaving the country and disappearing, or I'd be better off going into the underground economy. That's quite common. Not many people do make that decision because it's a very, very radical and very limiting to your own prospects. But certainly a lot of people think about it.
A lot of people here just quit work. They go on the dole or they go back to university. I haven't seen the statistics lately, but it's something like 42%,
I think.
Yeah,
that's correct. 42% of our child support agency clients are unemployed. or registered as unemployed with no income.
And that were dads that were just normal working dads prior to all that. They just don't see any point in paying all these onerous levels of tax to someone who can't be bothered to get off their butt. That's how they see it.
I'm sure that there is a very large category of people who are in Canada who are in similar circumstances. That is, their incomes were not very high in the first place, and their child support orders are fairly onerous, and that makes more sense for them to just give up.
One of the ironies of it is that we're getting this highly educated bunch of separated dads around the country. A number of them have gone and done law degrees, for example. So you're going to have all these separated dads flooding the legal system sooner or later as they graduate. It's rather an irony of the whole thing. So
can you
sum up for us what it looks like, the landscape there for separated parents at this point in time? A simple question.
Very simple. I would say that things are changing, and actually, probably the sheer onerous, isn't a very good word, onerousness of the provisions of the law are bringing about changes that weren't even intended by the people who drafted them that way. So, in other words, I think that the child support obligations have become so much more onerous ever since our child support guidelines were enacted in 1997 that that has brought about a psychological rebellion on the part of separated men who previously would have said, well, okay, the kids can go live with my wife. Now they see that these child support guidelines will just hammer them financially, and so they're not conceding the custody issue as frequently anymore. More men are starting to stand up and say, well, I want at least joint custody. I want my kids at least 50% of the time. So I do see that there is a trend in that direction, because men have become more assertive about getting custody, if only to avoid those extremely onerous support consequences. But in general, the average case still ends up with the children ordinarily spending most of their time with the mother, and fathers paying support to the mothers, fathers paying spousal support of some amount, depending on the relative incomes of the parents. And that doesn't generally last forever. It depends on how long the marriage was. And then there's sort of an equal division of property. That's another pet peeve of mine, but that's sort of the way things happen in general.
Right. Look, we're talking with Karen Selleck. She's a lawyer, family law lawyer from Canada. Today's show is a Canadian special, and we're looking at the whole family law scene and the family scene over in Canada. If you'll just stay on the line, Karen, we'll be back in a moment.
Another one. twisted maid. One of three half brothers dealt the hand of spades. His dad said, here's a bag of dope, get a coat and have some fun to run. This is how things are done. She says, I'm under the same roof with a teenage boy. It man is ripped, yet they talk with joy. In a bikini the size of a 6-year-old. Why do you think the blood runs cold?
Dads in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with Karen Selleck. She's a family law lawyer over in Canada. You there, Karen?
Yes, I am.
Good. Now, look, just the blokes coming into your office, what sort of state are they in? I mean, here they're often very distressed and very upset, as Phil York, we've got in the studio here from Dads in Distress, would tell you.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I get...
Go on.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, I get all kinds, but frequently people are in extreme distress, men and women. Certainly, people who think that they won't get custody of their children or won't get to share custody of their children, or in particular if their wives are planning to move away with their children, they're in extreme distress. And then the financial burden doesn't help. I would get people that were in extreme distress. On the other hand, some people come in having negotiated a fairly reasonable sharing of both children and assets and finances with their spouse, and they just want a separation agreement written up. So those people are pretty well off in comparison.
Yep, fair enough. Do you, as a family law solicitor, do you have different aspects of how you treat those clients? You know, if one's the mother comes into your office, is there a certain way that you would treat the case versus if a father would come in?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, every client's case is unique, and so you have to listen to what the individual is trying to accomplish, and of course you have to do what they want. They are paying you to do that. But I must say that I do try to influence people sometimes to do things that they may not have originally thought of as being the right thing to do. And for instance, I will sometimes say to women, if women are adamant that they want sole custody, I will sometimes point out to them the advantages to having somebody to share the burden of parenting with, because it's not a piece of cake to be the sole parent. So, I would try to push people into a joint type custody arrangement, because I believe strongly in it.
Yep. So I guess part of your role is to act as like a mediator for these couples as well.
Not really.
But opening them up to new ideas and perhaps situations that they hadn't thought of before. And trying to steer them into the thoughts of what is in the best interest of the children.
Yes, since I've had a lot more experience of a huge variety of different families and how it works out for them than the average person coming in who's just been separated, I can certainly tell them about my experience where I have seen joint custody working very well.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen children going back between households a week at a time, and even though the parents might have been quite bitterly engaged in disputing over money, there are certainly households where those people are able to put their differences aside when it comes to raising their children and still do a good job with sharing the children's time.
Yeah, but generally it's generally those clients that don't actually make it through to see the magistrate in the court, though, isn't it?
Would not end up in trial.
Exactly. They've worked it all out. They've been mature about it, thought about all the different aspects and came to their decision. But, there's the other side which just want to fight, and stand up for not the children's rights, but their rights. And they end up in the family court and represented by someone like yourself.
But most people end up, even people who come in thinking that they're going to fight and actually fighting for some length of time, very few of those actually get to trial. I mean, out of 100 cases that come in where they don't have things worked out at the beginning and they say, I want to go to court, I want this, this, and this,
mm-hmm.
You start court proceedings, maybe one of 100 cases will actually go to trial.
Okay, well...
So these things get worked out a long way.
In Australia, it's about a 5 in 100. It's about a 5% of all cases.
Yeah, I may
cases.
Be wrong. I don't have actual statistics on it, but I know from experience that it's a very small percentage that do go to trial.
So this is an important point which is often used against the argument for shared parenting, which is that parents in high conflict, they always claim can't successfully and cooperatively share for their children, but you think it's perfectly possible.
It takes a lot of maturity and it takes a lot of guidance, I think, but certainly even if they don't get along that well, they can certainly continue to share the child's time so that the child is able to experience the care of both parents. Some people are able to do it better than others. But I hate to see the excuse used, and that frequently is an excuse that's used here, that the courts don't like to award joint custody or shared parenting if the parents can't cooperate with each other, and therefore if one person wants to, sort of tip the balance against shared parenting, then they just say, well, I can't cooperate with the other parent. So I think judges are starting to get a little bit wise to that now and saying, well, unless it's an extremely severe case where the people can't even talk to each other without violence or without verbal abuse, I think they are starting to give the benefit of the doubt to the person who's asking for shared custody.
But isn't a lot of this
one that's avoiding it?
Isn't a lot of this conflict actually caused by the system itself, where we've got a system of advocacy in court where parents are actually encouraged to go at each other, where you've got the psychologists and everybody else, they're all there trying to make money out of this tragic situation, usually at the families. I mean, doesn't that situation cause people to fight more than if they were just told, look, you've got to sort this out, they're your children, you cooperated to have them, now you've got to cooperate to the minimum degree to bring them up? I mean, surely getting them out of the advocacy, the court system, which basically just stirs up the passions and gets them fighting, surely getting them out of that system would help.
Well, I would like to see that as a default position in Canada. That is, I would like to see something more like what I understand the Australian system to be, and maybe even go further than that, where it is essentially the default position that unless there's some, serious reason why a parent is unsuitable, for instance, if the parent has actually assaulted the child or if the parent is in jail or, has a substance abuse problem, the default position would be that the parents would share the child's time. I would like to see that as the starting place. And if people came in to you know, or first realized from the time that they were separated that that was the default position, there might well be less fighting. They might just accept that and you know, realize that there's nothing to fight about. It would also,
I think that's
Canada,
so true.
Our child support.
That is so true, that if it was the default position, there would be no reason to fight.
But let's just get this clear, that in Australia, that is not the default position. The default position is that it's shared responsibility. It's not shared equal time.
Okay.
There's a big difference.
And certainly we don't even have a statement here that it's shared responsibility. We actually have a provision in our Divorce Act that says that the court is to give consideration to the willingness of either parent to provide the other with custody with access, but that's a far cry even from saying that they have shared responsibility.
Well, look, we're running out of time, Karen. I wondered if you could just sum up for us where you see the legislative environment in Canada over all these issues heading. Do you see a lot of hope in the future that this will become the default position?
I can't say that I see a lot of hope on the horizon from a legislative point of view, but I do definitely see things changing. That is, when I started doing this in 1985, it was commonplace. In fact, I was trying to think earlier, before we started the interview, of how many judges I heard say this, but I can think of at least four judges that I personally heard say things like, I think young children should be with their mother. And they would say this quite openly to the lawyers and the parties. Now, three of those judges have either retired or died, the ones that I'm thinking of. The fourth one is still on the bench here. But they've been replaced by a younger generation of judges who I think are starting to see the advantages of sharing custody, or they're starting to see how silly it is to say such things openly in the presence of lawyers who are going to write about them in the newspaper. but you know, there is a change, and the change is coming in part from the individuals involved in these things themselves. It's coming from fathers' rights groups, and I think it also is spurred on by the financial aspect, where, you know, people say, not only am I losing my children, but I'm being forced to pay for the privilege and pay very heavily. And all those things are coming together to really provide a lot of impetus for a movement towards shared custody.
We've been talking with Karen Selleck. She's a lawyer of 22 years' experience in Canada. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. That was great.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Karen Selleck. We'll be back in a moment.
So baby, just one kiss. She said, no, no, no. Romance ain't keeping me alive. I said, hey, babe, do you want a coo-coo-coo? She said, So I was left out in the cold. I said, you're what I've been dreaming of. She said, I don't want to go.
Oh, you know, she was digging the cat out.
Clap for the Wolfman, he gon' reach your record high.
Yes, baby, I'm your doctor of love.
Clap for the Wolfman, you gon' dig him till the day you die.
Everybody talk about the Wolfman's.
hotness of love.
75 or 80 miles an hour, she hops slow, slow, slow. Baby, I can stop right on a dime. I said, hey, baby, give me just one kiss. She said, no, no, no. But how was I to bide my time? I said, hey, baby, do you want a goo, goo, goo? She said, said, I'm about to overload. I said, you're what I've been living for. She said, I don't want to know.
Oh, you thought she was digging you, but she was digging me.
Clap for the Wolfman. He gon' rate your record high.
As long as you got the curves, baby, I got the angles.
Clap for the Wolfman. You gon' dig him till the day you die.
It's all according to how your boogaloo situation stands, you understand?
Clap for the Wolfman. Don't rate your record high.
You ain't gonna get him, cause I got him.
Clap for the Wolfman. You're gonna dig him till the day you die.
You might wanna try, but I gonna keep him.
Clap for the Wolfman. Clap for the Wolfman. Clap for the Wolfman. Clap for the Wolfman.
Dancing Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian pet and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help us just a phone call away. Dancing Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back. We're talking with Roger Galloway. He's a Member for Parliament in Canada. Welcome to the show, Roger.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Now, we're just, Ian here is going to just give some background on you for our listeners, so hold tight.
Certainly. Our next guest is popular ex-member of the Canadian Parliament, Roger Galloway. In his former motion to amend the Divorce Act, he stated that legal battles over child custody often lead lawyers to encourage their clients to complain of psychological abuse, and women in particular to complain about violence and abuse in order to gain the upper hand in disputes. He is a personal friend and frequent political ally of the liberal-turned-conservative-turned-independent Senator Ann Coulls, who has worked with her to reform Canada's divorce laws in recent years. Both Coulls and Galloway have sought to ensure greater custody rights for fathers. In furtherance of these concerns, Galloway has served as co-chair of the Special Joint Committee on Custody and Access, which recommended shared parenting as the norm in its report for the sake of the children issued in 1998. The report called for shared custody, repeal of the tender years doctrine, and strict rules of proof when abuse was alleged, more than 10 years after the report has been ignored by successive justice ministers and governments.
So why is that, Mr. Galloway?
Why do they ignore this?
Yes.
Part of it is money given to the feminist faction in Canada, which continues to churn out just endless bogus studies. And in Canada, there's an inordinate fear of the women's groups. They have no political clout. They have monetary clout in terms of government, but they have no political clout yet within the Canadian bureaucracy, certainly within the Justice Department. It's the women, the feminists, who run the divorce files. They run the policy end of it. So, of course, as long as they're there, it's never going to happen.
That's certainly the case here, too, I would say. How did that situation come about? How did they get so much power over the argument?
Well, in the late 80s in Canada, there was an event at a university in which a gunman killed 13 students. All of them, as it turned out, happened to be young women. They all happened to be in one part of the school when this crazy man struck. And governments since that time have been attempting to atone for the deaths of these young women. And in 1992 in Canada, and I'll try to keep this very brief, in 1992, the then government gave $10 million, which was a lot of money in those days, to a group of women to do a study. And out of that came a report which I mean, it's really quite laughable when you read it. But in fact, it's had a profound effect on the direction of government in this country, both federally and at the provincial level, the equivalent to your state level.
And what was that study called?
It was called Changing the Landscape.
Changing the Landscape.
And it was a group of feminists who got themselves a job to do this report and got themselves $10 million in the process. And, you know, it came up with conclusions that no one else has been able to duplicate since that time. But it really doesn't matter. It set a bar, which is impossible to find.
And presumably that report painted all men as violent and all women as victims
yeah.
and all the usual stuff.
It concluded that, I don't know, 60% of women in their lifetime are victims of violence. And, you know, everything had to change. Zero tolerance, which is now largely the rule in the provinces across Canada. So if a woman alleges that a man has been physically abusive towards her, the man is put in jail. And they have an investigation and sometimes a trial later.
And that's on the basis of no evidence whatsoever except her word.
None whatsoever. No.
None whatsoever.
You get better treatment if you robbed a bank.
That's unbelievable.
And that's the way it is in Canada. It's that men are deemed to be violent. So I still deal with I get a lot of calls from men, and much of it is in some way I confirm that, you know, their situation is not unusual. They think that they're some sort of monsters. And most of them will start a conversation by saying, you know, I'm not violent or I'm not abusive. And that's where we are, that men go around and apologize for who they are and have to deny at every turn that they are not violent people.
Well, yeah, especially with Canadians, because, I mean, Canada's never declared war on anybody that I know of. It doesn't have any sort of military history. I mean, all the Canadians that you meet when you're traveling, you know, they're not the kind of people who get involved in barroom brawls. You know, Canadians appear to be very peaceful, gentle people to me, having met lots in my travels. I'm just wondering if the fact that your average Canadian man is a gentle, decent human being, that this appears to be being used against them, and that they are now, like you said, the word of a woman is so dominant, has so many more rights than the word of a man. A man can go to jail on what a woman said and has no right of defence, and his own words are meaningless. I mean, is the fact that Canadian men are not violent enough, has that got something to do with this?
Well, I think that Canadian men are not political enough. Canadian men have not, for a number of reasons, been able to coalesce and fight back against this. In Canada, starting in the late 60s, women's groups started to be funded. Now, that was a different time. That was more about political inclusion. It was not about all this nonsense of violence and women's shelters. And so at that time, it was entirely different. But that, with time, evolved. So women have control of the money. There's no money here for fathers' groups. None whatsoever. Not a penny. But there's all endless money for women's groups.
How is that justified under sex discrimination laws and that sort of thing?
Well, in Canada, you know, we're very, very attuned to equality. And we have a Supreme Court which is very activist and has enunciated a number of rights. But men are not deemed to be a minority. You know, this is all about gender politics and group or identity politics, more properly. And men are not a group within that. Men are deemed not to be a disadvantaged group. Women are. There's no rationale for that, but that's the way it's evolved.
How has that changed the dynamics of an ordinary marriage in Canada when the bloke knows that all she's got to do is wake up in a bad mood and say he hit her and she owns everything? What's it done to the institution of marriage?
Well, slowly but surely it's crumbling. So, you know, more recent statistics would show that the number of people getting married is declining. Now, I think that's a phenomenon particularly in certain parts of Canada. In the province of Quebec, it's exceedingly high. The number of people there do not get married, because if you don't get married, you can still get thrown in jail, but the property repercussions aren't as great if it breaks down. And across the country, though, every year the numbers of people are who would in another time get married just aren't doing it. And so what happens is that many relationships are of a transient nature. So you have a lot of children who are born of relationships that have ended. And, you know, mom has moved on to another one and dad's moved on to another relationship. It leads over time to disintegration of a cohesive family unit.
And to a collapse of the society as a whole, doesn't it?
Sure it does. Absolutely. So we have in this country, at the provincial level, a number of government bureaucracies who pursue men to collect money. It's a huge government bureaucracy, and they're always tracking men, and they post these websites, you know, they call it deadbeat dads. It's very difficult for a man, this is not a very profound observation, it's very difficult for a man to have a relationship with a child he never sees. I mean, that's not a very profound observation. Yet, a father in this country may have to support a child well into adulthood. I mean, there are reported cases of 27-year-old so-called children being called children by the courts and dad having to pay for them.
How is that possible?
It's a lifelong, incredible financial commitment. But the courts...
27 years old. And they're still paying.
Years old, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Still paying, yeah. Incredible. I mean, there are many of them in their mid-20s, and the courts call them children. You know, we live in a country where a 14-year-old child can be deemed to be an adult for purposes of the criminal law, and a 27-year-old can be called a child for purposes of civil law, divorce. Yeah. None of it makes any sense. It's insanity.
It does sound like complete insanity. It sounds worse than here.
It's very, very bad here. So, you know, there are a lot of men languishing in jails. It's particularly bad for self-employed people in terms of payment, because self-employed people can have income which fluctuates according to the economy. As we all know, the economy is in a slump, and so dad's income goes down. But if they're self-employed, judges in this country impute income to them. That is to say, that if the father last year made, I'll say, $150,000, and this year is making $75,000, the judge will say to him, "Work harder, make more money."
They do the same here in regard to that. So
and the end result, though, is if dad can't work harder and make more money, then he's found in contempt of court and put into jail.
Yep, and then, you know, what good is that to the family? What good is that to the children?
In Australia and Canada are alike in that, you know, we abolished debtors' prisons when the British did. Yet we have it, we've reintroduced it through a side door today. So we have debtors' prison today. And it's called fathers in jail because they cannot meet their imputed income. It's very common.
And do you have any statistics on this, like the number of men that are in these sorts of situations?
No, I do not, and I have gone looking, and I think you're having Jeffrey Asher on the show. Perhaps he's been on.
Right, no, he's coming on after you.
Yeah, Jeff has done a lot of study on various aspects of divorce, and he may be able to offer it. One of the great challenges in terms of studies is that there is no money for these types of studies.
Well, no, no money for any study that might show a beneficial conclusion for blokes or for men.
Exactly. The money is only available for women's studies.
And you say that there's a myriad of so-called bogus studies. Why do you describe them like that, and what sort of studies are you talking about?
Well, they're endless. I mean, if you go to a university, and I know this to be essentially true in Australia, as well as Canada, the United States is rife with it. We now have devised these departments called women's studies, and for social sciences, firstly, it's not a terribly accurate. It's not a science in the acceptable sense of the word. Social science spots trends. And social scientists are to be disinterested and to be at arm's length from their work. But all of these women's studies, they form conclusions before they start. And more, I think much worse, is that they are not disinterested. They're not objective. They study one side, but they do not look for any balance in what they do. They only report, and there's this thing called relativism, they only report women's experiences. They never talk about what the effect is on the man or what the effect is on the child or children. It's all about women. So you get a one-sided, totally distorted view of life. And so this is where they come up with these studies where, you know, in Canada they say 8% of women are victims of violence.
What was that? 80?
Eight. This is the latest one. 8% of women are victims of violence. What they neglect to tell you is that 7.5% of men are victims of violence at the hands of women. So, you know, if I throw out the one statement saying all these women are victims of violence and fail to mention that men are more or less equally victims of violence in intimate relationships, then it casts a whole new meaning on this. It adds some balance to the discussion. And this is what is endemic in all of these women's studies.
We have a similar thing in this state, for instance, in New South Wales, where Sydney is, where all the hospitals, they have to, if a woman presents at a hospital with injury, they have to be to answer questionnaires about domestic violence. But if a man presents at a hospital with injuries, no such questions are asked.
So I know. We have a parallel law here. We also have one here now going where this is a provincial government in the province of Ontario, the largest Canadian province, has put up a bunch of money for teachers, they'll be all women teachers, in classrooms, and they are going to be trained to study and identify children in their classroom who are living in homes where dad is abusive. Well, firstly, that can't be done. That's just a lot of nonsense. But, you know, there's a few million dollars in it. Somebody's going to get it.
Somebody will get the money. Now, we had a study here recently basically showing that no women make false allegations in court. They basically asked something like 30 women, did you lie in court? And they all said no.
Well, there has been some evidence, and once again, I refer you to Jeff Asher, but there's one lawyer in particular in the city of Toronto who's been, this is not a terribly scientific survey, but he works in this court, he practices in this court, and he has told me that in terms of, we have domestic violence courts, all right, and there it's literally, you know, 95% men, or high, it's a higher number than that. Only men get charged, women never appear. And, you know, the acquittal rate in that court exceeds 95%. So you get all these guys going into court being charged with all kinds of terrible things, and virtually all of them getting off. Well, they're not getting off. They're found not guilty. They're being found not guilty because there is no evidence. Yet we haul them before court. So the big winners are probably the social workers, the people who offer these anger management courses, and, of course, the lawyers.
Well, that's being put up as a model which Australia could follow. There's a lot of talk about introducing domestic violence courts into Australia.
Well, oppose it, please. Oppose it all you can. It's just another forum for the women's lobby to haul men before courts. I mean, the big challenge is, the big lie, I guess, more properly in all of this, is that somehow courts and policemen and lawyers can become involved in intimate relationships and somehow objectively discern what is going on in the homes of this country, or your country and my country. And it can't be done. But in certainly in all Western countries, we have politicized marriage. We have politicized it through feminism, and the imposition of laws. And it just can't be done in any way. Nobody knows what's going on in a relationship when two people are arguing, a husband and wife. And nobody can objectively know what occurred. Yet every day we have trials that deal with this.
Do you see any hope for the future at all there? We had Maurice Vellacott on.
We have a conservative government in Canada now, and they made some noise in the beginning about revising it. And I think you may have talked to an MP by the name of Maurice Vellacott.
Yeah, we did. Yes, we did.
Mm. Now, that's a private member's bill, and I know Maurice. And, if the government were serious about it, they would take that bill and make it a government bill. But they're not serious about it. So it's a private member's bill. And they're it's literally impossible to pass one of those. It's only an hour a day in terms of the House of Commons, and it's anything that has any contentious edge to it will never pass. And so the government is really not sincere at all about changing divorce law. The Liberal government, of which I was a member, wasn't. And certainly this Conservative government is not either.
Why not? I mean, it's such a huge issue in the community. Why not?
Well, that was how I go back to the beginning that, they are hoodwinked in some ways by the bureaucracy, and I think that's the most powerful force. The bureaucracy, the policy advisors to ministers say, we have all these studies that show this, that, and the other thing, and therefore you can't change the law. There's a great movement, in many circles, particularly in Canada, certain academics, particularly the legal profession, believe that you're going to attain some sort of equality by following this road. I mean, this is a handful of people who have inordinate influence in terms of government policy. We live now in a world of experts, and whatever the experts say, then the ministers of the crown follow.
It's a really classic place of the mandarins and the masses, yeah. Isn't it? Look, we're running out of time, Roger. I wondered if you could just wind up by just giving us a snapshot of the landscape in Canada and what you see the present damage being done.
Well, the present damage is all inflicted upon men. That fathers are estranged from their children, that grandparents are estranged from their grandchildren, and the situation continues to get worse, that men have no rights in terms of their children, and men have no rights in terms of the courts, and children have no rights in terms of knowing both parents.
Well, thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. That's a very depressing conclusion, I must say, but it's been...
It's reality, isn't it?
Oh,
the truth hurts.
It is reality, yeah.
That's.
Thank you very much for calling. Good talking to you.
That's an appalling conclusion, but no doubt true. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking with Jeffrey Asher. He's a professor of men's studies in Canada. We'll be back.
For sure, you'll never ever fade. You're lovely, but it's not for sure. I won't ever change, and though my love is great, and though my love is true.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And our final guest this morning is Jeffrey Asher. Oh, I'm just being told that's not correct. Our final guest this morning is not Jeffrey Asher.
Having some difficulty with Jeffrey Asher, we'll just have to go to another story for a moment on the Department of Community Services in New South Wales.
Oh, yes, this condescending load of codswallop. This is a ripper. Minister for Community Services, the Honourable Linda Burney MP. Dads urged to pick up their game on parenting. The New South Wales government is encouraging dads to take a more hands-on role in raising their children with today's launch of a new parenting resource for fathers. Minister for Community Services Linda Burney said while more men have become primary carers, latest figures from Parentline, the New South Wales government-funded parenting advice line, indicate that women continue to carry the bigger load when it comes to parenting. That's all hard to understand. I mean, because the blokes have to go out to work. A lot of the women are going out to work now, and a lot of the children are being brought up by professionals who don't particularly care about them. Anyway, this particular piece goes on to state, in 2007-2008, Parentline received 599 calls from fathers, and in 2008-2009, there were 1,017 calls. That's almost a 60% increase in calls from dads, Miss Burney said. These statistics are heartening, but calls from dads fall far short of mothers. Mums still made about 80% of the calls to Parentline. This indicates, according to Miss Burney, that women still do most of the child rearing. Well, I think that is jumping continents from the... I don't think Parentline men... That to me suggests that men tend to call Parentline a lot less than women. Not that women do most of the child rearing. I think she's leapt continents to reach that particular conclusion. What do you think, Phil?
Yeah, I think so too, mate. I think it's just another example of the Department of Community Services not really knowing exactly the lay of the landscape in society. I could talk about a dad that was involved with the department. His whole family was involved, and the mother was seen to be unfit. But then the department was given legal custody of this child, and then gave the carer of this child back to the mother in a carer status. So she was unfit to look after the child legally, but then the department gave the child back to her. You know, it's just all these decisions that says, mum's the best gender, or females are the best gender for looking after children, is just ludicrous, you know? And then here they are saying, come on, dads, pick up your game.
Yeah, it's really condescending, isn't it?
It is.
Go on with this, Rave. According to figures from the last census in 2006, mothers spend an average of 55 hours and 20 minutes a week on childcare activities, and fathers, boo hiss, only 26 hours and 10 minutes. So, hey, look at that. That statistic there, well, that's damning, isn't it, eh? I mean, well, and who built all the roads and who built all the houses and, you know, I mean, what men do to what women do, this is just childish nonsense.
You know what sickens me, Ian, is, you know, you get all these studies out, you know. Now here's a study saying that dads spend 26 hours a week with their children.
And 10 minutes.
And 10 minutes, okay? What about the study that we reported on about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago that said on average fathers spend 10 minutes per day with their children? You know, so you've got one saying,
yeah,
you know, what,
26 hours, 10 minutes a week, and another one saying, well, 10 minutes a day, yeah, that's which, what, which 70, equates, 70 minutes an hour,
yeah,
and 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's it. So, you know, what is right here? What is right? You know, what is the average time that an Australian father spends with his children? Because, you know, who am I to believe? I'm only a member of the public like you are and like all our listeners are, you know? We have to be given this information by the media, but then the information seems to be totally left-handed or totally right-handed.
Yeah, it's not reliable no matter how you look at it.
No.
There's obviously something completely wrong going on here.
It just confuses the bejesus out of me, mate.
Well, and this is, I mean, when you consider that there are more women who live at home bringing up children, but, you know, who don't have a job, that is their number one occupation, what do they call it, a homemaker or something,
yep.
They make the, which is the traditional way it used to be, by the way, that we've all forgotten about. There's a larger proportion of women in that situation than men, and that obviously is going to skew these figures from the start, the fact that the husband, in most cases, is out doing a full-time job, so...
Now, we have finally.
Do we now?
Oh, we do. I'm sorry about that. That's all my fault. We finally do have Jeffrey Asher on the line. He's from Canada. He was a professor of men's studies. Jeffrey, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, good. Yes. Hi. Sorry about this. We're going to have to, we'll get a bit of a taste of what you're like for our listeners, I guess, and we'll come back to you next week and do a more full interview. So,
that would be fine.
Yes, I'm sorry about that. I just took the numbers down wrong, and I've been ringing everybody but you. So I'm very sorry about that.
You've pestered half of Canada, have you, John?
Oh, dear, I have.
Apologies to everybody else in Canada.
Yes. Now, let's just go back to the beginning. You were a professor of men's studies in Canada. Can you just talk a bit about that for a start? How did you come into that situation?
Initially, I taught about feminism because I thought it was an equal rights movement. But some bad things started happening.
I did women's studies in the 70s myself.
Yeah. Bad things started happening in the late 70s and early 80s, where the feminist rhetoric became embittered and bigoted. Men were called pigs. Sex, even by consent, was called rape. I thought something terrible was going wrong here. So I decided to look for other books and other materials. There was almost nothing. I had to do my own research. Luckily, the research was there for anybody to read. That, in fact, fathers were good parents. That, in fact, men were committed to marriage. That, in fact, the situation of men, at least in terms of health and crime, was far worse than women in every Western country. That men were not only committed to the family, but committed to the protection of women and children. Not only within their own family, but any other women and children. And that's why the human race survived. And I taught this course for quite a while. Here's something you'll find hard to believe. 2/3 of the students were young women. These were young women who had had it up to the eyebrows with feminist courses. They came into my class. They were enthusiastic. They were bright. They wrote excellent papers. And, of course, they passed this on to other teachers, most of whom, men and women, were feminists. Well, they went apoplectic. And after teaching my course for about 14 years, they terminated my career.
Really? So, which university was this?
This I taught at a place called Dawson College in Montreal, but I also lectured at McGill University, Concordia University, University of Western Ontario, and Trent as a guest lecturer there.
And what was the process by which this was terminated?
Beg pardon? Oh, well, it wasn't that I was terminated. My courses were canceled, the ones taught about men. And I was required to teach other courses for which I clearly was not competent. So what I did was I took early retirement. Then I appealed it, and the appeal, of course, was refused.
And on what grounds?
on the grounds that no feminist prejudice could be seen. Can you believe
really?
That?
Because you weren't advocating for feminism.
No, they were claiming that the termination of my courses had nothing to do with feminist politics. The key person who terminated my course was the head of the Women's Studies Department.
Oh, really? But it had nothing to do with it?
Of course not.
Oh, really? So what grounds did they claim?
They claimed that students felt uncomfortable in my class without any specific evidence, and that students would be better served if I taught courses on economics and business. That made no sense at all.
Anyways,
that's not important. That's all in the past, and I'm glad it's behind me. What's more important to me is that male students, and some women students, ask some very practical questions. What are we supposed to do about feminist jurisprudence and feminist dominance of both government, the courts, and the media? What practically can we do? The first question was from the men, should we marry? Now, I'm not too sure about that. Given the state of law in Canada, and you've gotten quite an earful on this, the state of law for the family and for men in Canada is abysmal. I try to advise my male students not to marry until they were 30. I said, look, that's not that difficult. Now, of course, this is difficult to say to young men who are in love and a high heat of passion. That's how most marriages are formed. I asked them to at least wait for a while. The next question was, should men have children? And since my students were college students, luckily to go on to university, the divorce rate for them is over 50%. Therefore, a man who fathers children in a marriage with a university graduate woman is more likely not to be living with those children within 5 years than living with them.
So why would you take the risk?
Not only would you take a risk, it's worse than that. What few people realize in the media, even worldwide, although your excellent work in Australia is much to be admired, is how much fathers love their children. Fathers love their children more than their own lives, as we see from horrible statistics on post-divorce suicides. This deep emotional commitment, which defines life, is something that fathers cannot give up easily. It means they give up everything they have devoted their whole life to, their family, their home, their income, their marriage. And in many cases, fathers are willing to reconcile in marriage. They're willing to tolerate problems or try to solve them just to maintain the family. Therefore, a question has to be asked, should men have children at all? Now, I must admit, to be forthcoming about this, I'm one of the rare exceptions. I fought for custody and I want it, but that was way back in 1974.
Dear.
And I must say that bringing up my daughter was the most fulfilling and most difficult experience of my life. Of course it transformed me. And of course I love my daughter, and she loves me. And now I am a grandfather, and who knows what's coming in the future.
great-grandfather before you quit.
Maybe. Who knows? No rush. But if fathers are going to be torn from the children they love, then maybe they should pause and think whether they should do this in the first place.
Which,
next.
Of course, they are every day. Every day it's happening.
All right, then a bit of caution. Who should you marry? It doesn't take much research to find those women who are less likely to divorce. They are religious.
Oh, really?
Therefore, a good place to meet a young woman is in your local place of worship.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if not only she attends, but her family attends, and your family attends. Now, this is not something you can contrive. You've either got it in your heart or you don't. Mm-hmm. Next, if the woman is a university graduate, divorce is much more likely. Men are likely to form more lasting bonds, I'm sorry to say, with women who are not university graduates. They're more committed to marriage.
Because they've been less indoctrinated.
I think so. And also because they realize that their university graduate or well-earning husband is vital to the rest of their life. And therefore, less likely to tear it asunder.
Because it provides security for the children and
yes,
social
and not
status.
Just financial security, emotional security.
Yeah.
It provides an ongoing family of love and care. So this might be another consideration. Now, I've got to admit, it's hard to do when a man's in a case of high passion. with a beautiful woman and having a sexual relationship with her. But it doesn't hurt to mention caution. Doesn't hurt to mention those conditions under which a marriage is more likely to last. Mm. Also, marriages are more likely to last, I'm sorry to say, with partners who are less sexually experienced. The more sexual partners they have before marriage, the more likely both are to divorce. If they live together for a long period of time before marriage, they're more likely to divorce. If they live together and don't marry, they're more likely to separate.
Really? So we're really right out of time now, unfortunately, and it's my fault. I accept all full blame. We're going to have Jeffrey Asher on as the first guest next week, and so anyone that's been listening to the Canadian special, my apologies for that, and we'll have Jeffrey Asher on as a first guest up next week, so that should be interesting. You've just had a great taste of what you can expect next week. So look, thank you very much for coming on to Dad's on the Air, and I'm
you're welcome.
My apologies for the muck-up. It's one of the beauties of live radio. You never quite know what's going to happen.
By the way, far more important, thank you for the wonderful work you're doing in Australia.
No, thank you very much. That was Jeffrey Asher. He was a professor of men's studies in Canada, and once that course was gone, that was the only such course in Canada. It's now gone. There are no men's studies courses in Canada at all.
Nope.
Unbelievable. We'll be back next week. Don't forget that you can listen to this program at www.dadsontheair.net. It has been redesigned. It's much more functional. Very beautiful work now. Dadsontheair.net. You can listen to that show. Thank you so much. We'll be back next week.
We're dead on the air.